This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com.
And this is James Evan Pilato of MediaMonarchy.com, and we both welcome you back to another jam-packed episode of The New World Next Week, which, of course, you can find on NewWorldNextWeek.com. And as we announced to you last week, thanks to the folks at ParadigmShift.tv, if you are in Europe, you can now catch this show thanks to the Sky satellite. So, James, without further ado, let's get to this week's stories. And our first story goes straight to your backyard. From the Sydney Morning Herald, Cablegate shows Japan set up secret intel unit to spy on China. For the first time since World War II, Japan is establishing a secret foreign intelligence service to spy on China and North Korea and gather information to prevent terrorist attacks. The spy unit has been created under the wing of Japan's peak intelligence agency, the Cabinet Intelligence and Research Office, or NACHO. It's modeled on Western intelligence services such as the CIA, the Australian Secret Intelligence Service, and Britain's MI6. The existence of a new Japanese espionage capability is revealed in a leaked U.S. diplomatic cable obtained by WikiLeaks and provided exclusively to the Sydney Morning Herald. Japanese military and naval intelligence, together with the infamous secret police, the Kempeitai, ran extensive spy networks throughout East and Southeast Asia up to the end of World War II. Successive post-war governments in Tokyo have been reluctant to establish a foreign espionage service for fear of diplomatic risks. Tokyo's need for intelligence collection to complement its signals and technical intelligence capabilities was supported by candid admissions to American counterparts about the lack of information on North Korea's secretive leadership. Now, if we jump down to the very last paragraph of this article, it notes that NACHO head also confessed that Japan's best insights into Mr. Kim Jong-il came not from a secret source, but from his Japanese former sushi chef who published a memoir. James.
Well, an interesting story indeed, and certainly interesting in the light of the recent remilitarization of Japan that's been going on quietly and sort of informally over the last several years, and just sort of introducing it to the Japanese public here. But I think this story is interesting for what it shows, but also I think we'd have to be naive to believe that the Japanese haven't been conducting this type of surveillance and spying over the years, even without the formal creation of an office or an intelligence bureau per se. And I think there's a recently I was watching listening to an excellent interview with Sterling Seagrave on Black Op Radio, and I'll have to listen to it a few more times because it is just jam-packed with information. But basically he was going over the history of how the Japanese imperial family was using Japanese secret societies in Korea and in Manchuria to conduct surveillance and intelligence operations, and to loot the gold, which was looted from various Southeast Asian countries over the 50-year period of Imperial Japan aggression, and then was stored in the Philippines, and where that gold went and how it was perhaps pilfered off by the U.S. and all. A very interesting story, but it sort of shows how there's a lot of ways in which the Japanese government is there for show, and what really happens under the surface is the secret societies and the imperial family, and of course the Japanese mafia, which is famously has an understanding with the Japanese police, and so there's a lot going on underneath the surface of this type of story. But at any rate, it's very interesting to hear about the open creation of a Japanese version of the CIA, and we have to watch out for that because, of course, we know what the CIA has been up to around the world over the years.
Mm-hmm. As we will see further in just a few moments. So we will provide a link to that interview with Sterling Seagrave in the show notes for this episode. And we'll also mention that within this Sydney Morning Herald article, it notes that this cable goes back to 2008. So here we are in 2011. So chances are if they were going to set something up, it has been set up and is most likely operational. James, as a sort of sidebar to this, since we're discussing your backyard in Japan, I'll make a brief note about my backyard here in Portland, Oregon, where we just learned yesterday that they've now delayed the decision of whether or not Portland is going to rejoin the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force, this all coming in the wake of Muhammad, the Portland tree bomber patsy, set up and funded and trained by the FBI. So we see these things that, again, it comes out years after the fact sometimes, and it's just another notch, it's just another confirmation of things that we generally have already been aware of, unfortunately. So before I digress too much, James, let's move to our second story. And we'll take this from allgov.com. U.S. admits American arrested for murder in Pakistan worked for the CIA. Classified a diplomat by the Obama administration until this past Monday, February 21st, the man arrested in Pakistan for killing two men in Lahore has turned out to be employed by the CIA. After conducting interviews in the U.S. and Pakistan, the British newspaper The Guardian concluded that Raymond Davis was a former Army Special Forces soldier now employed by the CIA. One senior Pakistani intel official was quoted as saying, "It's beyond a shadow of a doubt that Davis was working for the spy agency at the time he gunned down two Pakistanis." Following the Guardian story, U.S. officials admitted Davis was a security contractor working for the CIA. Like other American news outlets, the New York Times initially sat on the story of Davis working for the CIA after the administration asked that the information not be released while he was still in Pakistani custody. U.S. officials argued the revelation could put Davis's life at risk. But of course, once The Guardian published this story and the CIA lifted its requested hold, the New York Times produced its own account, which described Davis as being part of a covert CIA-led team collecting intelligence and conducting surveillance on militant groups deep inside the country. Davis has been charged with murder by Pakistani police. He shot the two men allegedly for trying to rob him while he was driving through Lahore. Local authorities say the American was found to be carrying a Glock handgun, a flashlight attached to a headband, a pocket telescope, three cell phones, facial disguises, and multiple ID cards. He is reported to have worked for years as a mercenary for the CIA, including a period with Z, the private security contractor formerly known as Blackwater. Many Pakistanis have been enraged by the news of an armed American gunning down local citizens. If the U.S. convinces the Pakistan government to turn Davis over to American authorities, Egyptian-style anti-government protests could erupt, analysts say. The government has said it will wait until March 14th to decide what to do with Davis. And James, before I throw it back to you, we'll throw in a couple of updates as this story has grown and grown over these last few days. From Redacted News, two CIA contractors spirited out of Pakistan. These would be two of the compadres, as it were, to Raymond Davis, who managed to escape being arrested. And just today, Danger Room put up an article called CIA Spy Sparks Conspiracy Palooza. And this is a reference to the questionable article coming from EU Times. CIA spy Davis was giving nuclear bomb material to Al-Qaeda. James?
Yes, well, questionable indeed, considering the source. But again, who knows what's really going on underneath the surface here. But I think people who have been following Pakistan for any length of time will know that the idea that the CIA is deeply rooted in the country is not a particular surprise, especially since the CIA founded, funded, established the Pakistani version of its of itself, the ISI, and was using that in Afghanistan in the 80s as the conduit for funneling funds and all of that sort of thing that people probably know by now. But at any rate, yes, it's an interesting story, but I think it's one of those stories where we'll have to really wait to see how it unfolds on the geopolitical scale to find out what was really happening here, because I think either this will be used as a point of tension to try to create more destabilization in the region and perhaps move the current wave of protests and riots and things over to Pakistan, or it could be something that genuinely the CIA and the U.S. would like to cover up, in which case it'll be swept under the rug and we won't hear much about it again. So I think we won't know for sure what this is and until we start to see how it plays out, but it is interesting nonetheless, if not surprising.
So for our third and final story this week, James, when I saw the news, it kind of surprised me because I guess I just thought that the election was going to happen this November. But no, lo and behold, this past Tuesday, Rahm Emanuel elected Chicago's first Jewish mayor. And we'll take this appropriately enough from IsraelNationalNews.com. Former Obama White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel has been elected Chicago's first Jewish mayor. He faces a series of challenges, beginning with the fact that his last name is not Daley. His predecessor, Richard M. Daley, and his father, Richard J. Daley, have controlled the city of nearly 3 million people for 42 of the past 55 years. The current economic crisis in the U.S. has affected the Midwestern city as it has others, leading to an estimated budget deficit of some $600 million. Nevertheless, Emanuel's popularity may stand him in good stead, at least initially. The 51-year-old former congressman won 55% of the vote in a field of six candidates, thus ending the need for a runoff in April. Jerry J. Chico, a former chief of staff to incumbent mayor Richard M. Daley, his closest competitor, garnered less than half with only 24%. Emanuel is known as a tough pragmatist and for his blunt manner of speaking. During his tenure as chief of staff in the Obama White House, he told an Israeli diplomat that the United States was, quote, fed up with Israel. Less than a year later, however, as he considered a run in the Chicago mayoral race, he told rabbis that the Obama administration had screwed up the messaging and failed to convey its support for the Jewish state. The man commonly referred to as President Barack Obama called Tuesday night to congratulate Emanuel, saying, as a Chicagoan and a friend, I couldn't be prouder. James.
Hey, James, do you hear that? I think it's the sounds of a victory celebration at Man's Country. Yes, well, for people who don't get that reference, perhaps they can refer back to my recent podcast episode on Meet Rahm Emanuel, but suffice it to say that this is an extremely worrying turn of events, and I genuinely, I truly mean this when I say I certainly hope that the residents of the Windy City will be able to survive the Rahm Emanuel mayoralty. But for people who don't know, the quick synopsis is that Rahm Emanuel, of course, very much part of the political machine in Chicago, and also, of course, he was part of the Israeli Defense Force during the Gulf War. He volunteered to work with them, and he's been unfortunately involved in a lot of scandals. He was involved with Freddie Mac at a time when they were going through some accounting scandals and things like that, and it's just continued through the Obama administration. And if again, if people want more information on this, they can go to my podcast. Wayne Madsen's been doing some good work exposing this, but at any rate, it is a really worrying turn of events. But hey, James, maybe you can remind me, what's the name of the new chief of staff at the White House?
I think his last name is Daley. Oh, that's right. He's the brother of the now former mayor of Chicago. And James, this goes right to the heart of Chicagoland, of gangsterland. And I'll flash this quickly. Barack H. Obama, the unauthorized biography from Webster Tarpley, really gets into the heart of the Chicago machine and Tony Rezko and Ouchie and Valerie Jarrett and the Chicago Annenberg Challenge and Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn and all of these things that, again, James, as you said, we're hopeful and we'll pray for the people of Chicago. And good Lord, Larry Silverstein owns the Sears Tower, and just bad news.
Unfortunately, so. I mean, things are lining up in Chicago in a similar way to that they were just prior to 9/11 in New York. So again, let's hope that nothing comes of it. But at any rate, it's not happy news to end on, but we'll have to end it there. So, James, Evan Pilato, thank you once again for taking the time to talk with us.
Thanks so much. Take care.